it's a real honor to be here, and I'd like to thank both Jackie as my sponsor and the Institute for Advanced Studies. This is my first time at the University of Warwick, and I hope it's not my last. It's also, with some trepidation that I present this overview of a book that's probably too late to change, if I'm wrong, at a university that is so renowned both for its law school writings on the history of intelligence agencies, security studies, and the like. So it's a really a great pleasure and honor to be here. Talk a little bit about what I try to do in the book. It really does, I think, grow from a collection of essays that I was fortunate enough to co-edit with a number of people, global anti-terrorism law and policy, where we looked at, I think, more jurisdictions than are typically the case in most studies in this field. The project was started in Singapore, and we had a pretty good representation from that region, Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia, and we've been able to expand it to the Middle East and Israel in the new editions. And it was really working with a group of scholars that convinced me that we needed to, look at this in a broad global perspective, not one that necessarily focuses just on the United States and the United Kingdom. The way that I approach this is I am an academic lawyer, but I, kind of hope to write something that David Garland has described as kind of a history of the present. So what I try to do is take the law and the institutions seriously, but also hopefully explore some of the history and sometimes even sociology of the countries I am examining. I also come from a legal scholarship tradition that's rooted in the study of the legal process, so I'm quite interested in the interactions between various institutions, specifically legislatures, the executive, and courts. And this project has really forced me to learn a lot more. I really knew very little when I started about the United Nations, because I think in order to understand what has happened since 9/11, you really do need to understand the role of the United Nations, and in particular its Security Council, which many have described as taking the role of a global anti-terrorism legislator. Not only a global anti-terrorism legislator, and I'll talk about that, but also a global executive that has taken the lead in listing terrorists, and in particular terrorists associated with Al-Qaeda. Another of my particular interest is the issue of accountability. As Jackie said, I've been fortunate enough to be able to look at accountability really from both sides of the coin. That is, with the work that we did with respect to Mayor Arar, we were focused on the need for accountability for Canadian complicity in torture, an issue that is also quite relevant here in the United Kingdom. As soon as that ended, a different government in Canada appointed an inquiry in 2006 to look into the 1985 bombing of Air India. And that inquiry was not only about what had happened or failed to happen in 1985 in the investigations after, but really looked at the issue of accountability for the efficacy of counterterrorism activities. And there were some people in the security services who predicted that the Arar Commission would recommend not sharing information, and the Air India Commission would recommend sharing more information. And so I made it kind of my personal obsession to try to reconcile the recommendations of those two commissions. But although those are Canadian commissions, I do think that they have a relevance outside of Canada because they really do speak to the difficulties of accountability for secret national security activities, difficulties that are made even more complex when we add the transnational nature of so much contemporary counterterrorism. So it's not enough to understand what is going on in Ottawa. You also need to try to understand, and often, unfortunately, this will prove impossible, what is going on in Washington, Damascus, and Cairo. And then finally, I hoped through this study, which examines in detail four countries, in less detail another five countries, to provide some sense of the overall trajectory since 9/11. Although I should add that I'm not in the school that everything has changed since 9/11, and in each of the chapters, I devote a significant amount to the pre-9/11 history of each country, because in many ways, there are very important stories of continuity. That said, things have changed, not everything, but some things have definitely changed, and often not for the better. That's kind of an overview of what the project's about. Let's go into some of the nitty-gritty of what various countries and the UN have done since 9/11. The Security Council really emerged as the dominant force, particularly after 9/11. What many people don't realize, though, is the Security Council had already engaged on these issues under Security Council Resolution 1267, which had started out as a sanctioning regime against the Taliban and was expanded to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda in 2000. So there already was an individual sanctions and listing regime in place. That regime obviously failed to prevent what is, by all accounts that I've read, the most expensive act of terrorism in history. The 9/11 Commission has estimated that the 9/11 plot cost somewhere between $400,000 and $500,000 American. And so you might think that if this terrorism financing and individual sanction regime of the 1267 process had failed to prevent 9/11, you might think that the Security Council might rethink the efficacy of this regime. Rather than rethink, the Security Council heavily reinvested in terrorism financing. And so if you read Security Council Resolution 1373, which is really the, you know, one piece of global legislation that most commentators will point to, it's almost entirely concerned with terrorism financing. Why is this so? Well, obviously, bin Laden's, it turns out to be exaggerated, reputation as a financier played a role, but the existence of the 1267 resolution and committee and the fact that the most recent counterterrorism convention concerned terrorism financing played a role. So essentially, the Security Council, acting even before the Patriot Act was passed, turned to what was at hand. And what was at hand was terrorism financing. And it heavily reinvested in the regulation of terrorism financing, despite some really serious concerns about the efficacy of trying to stop acts of terrorism through cutting off the funding. Because although 9/11 was relatively expensive, as people in this room well know, many other deadly acts of terrorism, not the least the 2005 London bombings, can basically be financed on someone's MasterCard. So the UN reinvested in terrorism financing. Now, no one really thought about it at the time, but we're also seeing that the reinvestment in terrorism financing is not only of dubious efficacy, but also has human rights costs. And the European Court in the Cadi case, your Supreme Court in the Ahmad case, and a court in Canada in the Abdel Razak case, have all pointed out the unfairness and the injustice of a listing process that is based on secret intelligence submitted to the Security Council, probably largely from American intelligence services, that essentially are used to make someone a listed terrorist and a international outlaw. Once you're listed, it then becomes a violation of 1267 and 1373, both enacted under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, and a violation of many domestic laws to have anything to do financially with the listed person. Other problems with the initial response by the Security Council to 9/11 is it singled out the denial of refugee status to two suspected terrorists as one of the things that nations should do. Now, certainly there are examples of terrorists applying for refugee status. One in Canada was the Ahmad Rassam case. But none of the 9/11 hijackers applied for refugee status. They didn't need to. They could get visas much more easily. And an application for refugee status will, in fact, often attract more attention. And although Mr. Rassam applied for refugee status in Canada, he was actually denied refugee status, yet he remained in the country and was only apprehended at the millennium when he was entering the United States with plans to bomb the Los Angeles International Airport. So the 1373 mention of refugee status was also the only time that that resolution mentioned international human rights. So essentially it told all member states, don't grant refugee status to terrorists, but don't violate human rights. And what this did is presented a real conundrum, and it's a conundrum that really none of our countries have solved. What do you do with a terrorist who comes, say, from a country like Syria, where if you know if they are returned to their country of citizenship, they will be tortured? So Security Council Resolution 1373 not only started the train down the road of using immigration law as anti-terrorism law, but it really told countries, well, solve this seemingly insolvable dilemma. What do you do with the terrorists from Syria? Now, our countries resolved this in somewhat different ways. The initial response in this country was to derogate from fair trial rights under the European Convention and to authorize indeterminate detention of those who could not be deported, of suspected terrorists who could not be deported because there was a substantial risk that they would be tortured if returned to countries like, say, Syria. That was a legal approach. It was obviously a controversial approach that was later struck down by the House of Lords in the 2004 Belmarsh case, but it was a legal approach. In some ways, I think it's more preferable than the approach that was taken in my country under the Suresh decision, which was a unanimous decision decided in 2002 by the Supreme Court of Canada, including, I might add, Louise Arbour, who went on to become the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. What our Supreme Court said in Suresh was essentially, one, we will defer to the executive in deciding whether there is a substantial risk of torture if you are deported. And two, although there is an absolute international law right against refoulement or deportation to torture, there is not an absolute right under the Canadian Constitution. And so the Supreme Court of Canada said, we're not ruling out the possibility that in exceptional circumstances, we will deport someone to torture. Now, fortunately, no Canadian court has actually found that the exceptional circumstances held out in Suresh and never really defined, no Canadian court has found exceptional circumstances justify deportation to torture. But these two responses, and to that I guess we could add the American response, where, as Michael Schur said, assurances were received that weren't worth a bucket of spit from countries like Egypt that people would not be tortured. So 1373 really set a number of countries down the road of using immigration law as anti-terrorism law, and really did not resolve what I've suggested is a fairly insoluble problem of what you do in a deportation to torture circumstance. What else did 1373 do? Well, 1373 called on all states to ensure that they had laws against terrorism and, of course, the financing of terrorism. But it said not one whit about how we should define terrorism. And this is, I know some people in this room may disagree with me, including my sponsor. But to me, this was a real lost opportunity, because I think that if efforts had been put to work on a general definition of terrorism in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And recall, this is that time in history when we were all Americans. We all had sympathy for 9/11. And if the U.S., which drafted 1373, had stressed the issue of a definition of terrorism, and particularly if it has stressed the general definition of terrorism, which is contained in the 1999 Financing Convention, which was all over 1373, but nowhere was that general definition mentioned. I think that if pressure had been put, we might have at least had some guidance and perhaps even international agreement about a definition of terrorism. That general definition that I'm talking about is a fairly minimalist one, especially minimalist compared to what most countries look to for a definition of terrorism after 9/11, and that is the definition of terrorism or terrorist activities contained in Section 1 of your Terrorism Act 2000. But the general definition in the 1999 convention essentially is one that prohibits causing the death or serious bodily harm to civilians or other persons who are not engaged in hostilities during an armed conflict. And I do think that that is the best definition of terrorism that I've heard of. It may very well not be a perfect definition. It certainly, in my view, would have captured 9/11, including the attack on the Pentagon. I think it's an issue that perhaps only future historians will be able to address about why the U.S. and the Security Council, largely following the U.S., decided not to take on the admittedly thorny and intractable definition issue. But as I said, in the absence of any guidance from the Security Council, the British definition became at least the starting point for many countries, Canada, Australia, South Africa, Singapore, Israel, and other countries. All of the countries put glosses and often adopted a slightly less expansive definition than is contained in Section 1 of the Terrorism Act 2000. But they're all broad definitions that include some elements of property damage, some elements of disruption of essential services. And with that broad definition comes an increased risk of targeting illegal protesters, whether it's of the animal rights, globalization, Aboriginal, or other varieties. And so this I see as a real missed opportunity that was there in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. The other thing that 1373 did was create a counterterrorism committee, which still exists. And the counterterrorism committee, if those you may not be familiar with its work, it has a website. It's a real resource for researchers, because until very recently, and for reasons that are still unexplained to me. There's been no public reasons. I've asked for reasons, and I've received no response. The CTC posted country reports from each country responding to Security Council Resolution 1373 and subsequently Resolution 1624. And although these are reports that are written by governments, they are very, very interesting reading. And so for those of you who want to engage in any comparative research in this area, I would go to the website until I fear that they may eventually take the existing ones down, and I don't understand why they're not posting the new ones. And one of the concerns about the Counterterrorism Committee, and it has responded to this in recent years, but I think it is fair to say that in the first 3 years of its existence, at least, it operated in kind of a rights-free zone. So the issue that the Counterterrorism Committee was concerned with was whether nations were complying with Resolution 1373. And you see many nations really recycling laws that had been criticized for an abuse of human rights before 9/11. They're being recycled through the CTC committee process and the 1373 process and dressed up in the now fashionable garb of counterterrorism. I've picked on the UN. Let's go on to some other countries that I look at. I look at Egypt, Syria, Israel, and Singapore, partly for opportunistic reasons. I knew a little bit about some of these countries. But they were really all countries that, unlike the Western democracies, did not enact massive new counterterrorism laws in order to comply with Security Council Resolution 1373 and the 90-day reporting deadline that was set for the first country reports to the new CTC, the new Counterterrorism Committee. Now, all of these regimes relied upon existing administrative detention regimes. Now, what I mean by administrative detention is all of these regimes allowed people to be detained as security risks on the basis of an administrative process based upon secret evidence that was not disclosed to the detainees. And as we will see, many Western democracies started to mimic these processes of administrative and military detention. But it's interesting that these four countries, all with experience with terrorism and harsh laws against terrorism, really did not have to do anything in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Some of them, and we'll talk about this, added terrorism financing, but that was really just a bells and whistles. The meat of counterterrorism in all of these countries was achieved through existing regimes, administrative or military detention. Similarly, all of these regimes allowed extensive regulation of associations and speech. They all had forms of what you would call control orders. They're not necessarily called control orders, but the Internal Security Acts in Singapore and Malaysia in particular allow people to be released upon conditions. And the Internal Security Act also contemplates the use of immigration law as anti-terrorism law stemming out of the Malay emergency, where deportation to China, at least until it was taken over by the communists, was a favored counterterrorism tools. Now, these countries, although they were able to retain and rely on their harsh laws and to report them to the CTC as forms of compliance with Security Council Resolution 1373, they all added terrorism financing laws in response to both Security Council Resolution 1373 as well as the Financial Action Task Force, which had already established itself as a pretty heavy presence in the money laundering field, and after 9/11 simply tacked on terrorism financing to its money laundering regimes. And so you'll see in all of these countries, you have these off-the-shelf, transplanted terrorism financing / money laundering laws enacted after 9/11, largely to ensure that they were not criticized by the Counterterrorism Committee, and perhaps more to the point, in an attempt to get themselves removed from the Financial Action Task Force lists of non-cooperative countries. And like the basic terrorism financing regime that I talked about in terms of Security Council Resolution 1267 and 1373, there's real concerns about these approaches in terms of efficacy. Largely what they did is they tacked it on to money laundering. Well, the problem is money laundering and terrorism financing are two very different phenomena. Money laundering is what do you do with large gobs of illicit cash, cash that comes from organized crime. Terrorism financing is what do you do about perhaps small amounts of money that may either be derived from crime, but may also be derived from charitable donations, employment in, income, and the like. And in many of these countries, including the United States, terrorism financing was essentially just tacked on to money laundering. And there's a real efficacy concern. Similarly, there's a human rights concern because all of these regimes rely upon lists, lists that can be distributed to financial institutions. So you say, okay, Joe Blow is listed. We've received something from this person. We're going to freeze his account and notify the authorities. Now, these countries did, as the years roll by, they did catch up with the 9/11 effect. And so in Israel especially, you see the enactment of a 2002 law that's generally translated as the internment of unlawful combatant law. And this built on existing schemes, a 1979 law on administrative detention. But the Israeli law is interesting because it borrows, of course, this language of unlawful combatant, which was very much the language of the Bush administration. And this 2002 law, like the Bush administration's response in Guantanamo, indeed the Obama administration's response, only applied to non-citizens who were unlawful combatants. So the Israeli 2002 law is an interesting echo of some of the American policies. And interestingly enough, it was upheld by the Israeli Supreme Court in a unanimous decision in 2008, where the Israeli Supreme Court recognized that it was quite a harsh law, rejected the idea that unlawful combatants was a category in law, so accepted, as it did in its targeted killing case, that the world is divided between combatants and civilians, but nevertheless accepted that there could be administrative detention of non-citizen unlawful combatants on the basis of secret evidence that was subject to no adversarial challenge at all. Another interesting development in 2007, one that's recently been reversed, is in 2007, Egypt amended its constitution to provide constitutional shelter for any new counterterrorism law or security law that was going to be adopted. So very much like Singapore and Malaysia, what this did is it said any new law could not be challenged under most of the regular constitutional rights that would apply. Even more interesting, and again, I think in an echo of American practice, provided a constitutional amendment that the president would have powers to transfer any terrorism or security case to any court. So essentially constitutionalizing the ability to transfer cases to military courts. This was controversial. President Mubarak, even before he resigned, offered to repeal this, and subsequently in the recent constitutional referendum in Egypt, these amendments have now been annulled. So this is an example of a kind of rollback of a 9/11 effect. And we're starting to see rollbacks, obviously, in Egypt, given recent changes. But as you're well aware, some rollbacks, the so-called correction in favor of liberty in this country. The last of a country that I'll mention before moving towards the Western democracies is Indonesia. Which is really, I think, quite a fascinating case study. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, Indonesia added a new terrorism financing law. It was both a money laundering and a terrorism financing law. This was in response to FATA, the Financial Action Task Force, and the Security Council mandates. But if you look at that law, it really is an off-the-shelf sort of law that makes no discernment between the large amounts of money that are transferred in money laundering or operations and the often small amounts of money that are used to finance terrorism and finance the terrorist infrastructure. So that was job number one in Indonesia right after 9/11. And given the Bali bombings, I think there's some real efficacy concerns about making terrorism financing regimes job number one after 9/11. In Indonesia, there's obviously issues of capacity, but there's also, frankly, legal issues. And I was asked to go to Indonesia before the Bali bombings, and they asked me when I was there, do we need a counterterrorism law? And I think they expected me probably to say no, because I had been quite critical of Canada's counterterrorism law. But I said, well, I really can't answer that question unless I know a little bit more about Indonesian criminal law. And when I learned a little bit about Indonesian criminal law, my advice was, well, you either have to change your criminal law so you have real offenses, real inchoate offenses of conspiracy and attempt, or you have to do so through a counterterrorism law. There was an initial draft of a counterterrorism law introduced after the money laundering law went in, but it was withdrawn, over quite legitimate concerns that it would be a reversion back to the Suharto era, which had only ended in 1998 and had some quite draconian provisions with respect to incommunicado detention, preventive detention, and the like. After the 2002 Bali bombings that killed 202 people, there was a counterterrorism law passed as what's known as a perpu in Indonesia. That is, it was passed as a presidential regulation, later was ratified by the legislature, and had a quite controversial provision that allowed the use of intelligence as preliminary evidence. So would allow the use of secret intelligence not disclosed to the accused to be used to ground an initial detention period, really a period of investigative tension. As we will see, this issue of the use of intelligence as evidence is, to my mind, one of the most important effects of 9/11. The Indonesian story continues. As you know, there have been many acts of terrorism in Indonesia. The Perpu was found to be unconstitutional to the extent that it tried to apply itself retroactively to the Bali bombings. And there are continued demands within Indonesia and from without for harsher ISA laws and increased involvement of the military. And so Indonesia, unlike Syria, Egypt, Israel, and Singapore, is an interesting kind of case study because it shows how a very new and very fragile democracy really has to juggle the very serious terrorist threats, demands that effective action be taken against terrorism with attempts to maintain its new democratic character. Well, moving on, what is the 9/11 effect when we look at the democracies of the United States, the UK, Australia, and Canada? Well, I think in some ways you can see this as democracies without the same experience of terrorism catching up to experienced jurisdictions. And here, of course, the UK is the most experienced of those four democracies. And so as I suggested, the Terrorism Act 2000 really became, you know, not that it was transplanted holus bolus, but became a very important influence post 9/11. So we now have some, I think, degree of convergence between the Western democracies and some of the countries that we've examined before. We have broad laws, increased regulation of speech, association. We have control orders. We have increased interest in administrative, military, and preventive detention, often based on secret evidence that is not disclosed to the detainee. We have in the United States, and especially under the Obama administration, an increased interest in targeted killing. So there is a narrative that you find when you read some of these countries' reports to the CTC, especially comes out in Egypt and Syria, also comes out in Israel's reports, that basically says, look, we've been dealing with terrorism for a long time. Now you guys in the privileged West are finally catching up to us, and you're starting to see that what we were doing kind of makes a little bit of sense. Obviously, the extraordinary rendition program of the United States allowed President Mubarak and others in Egypt to say, well, basically, this confirms that the way we're doing it actually has some wisdom after all. So there is, I think, a degree in which the Western democracies have learned and transplanted some of the laws and practices of some of the regimes that I have talked about, but often without some of the restraining effects even in those regimes. So, for example, the American targeted killing program is conducted without even the pretense of judicial review of targeted killing that you see in Israel. I don't want to suggest that judicial review is foolproof, but I think it's interesting that American practices now mimic Israeli practices with respect to targeted killing, but when it comes to judicial review, judicial review is a non-starter in the United States. Why? Because standing issues, political questions issues, state secrets issues. Similarly, we have administrative detention in countries like Canada and the United Kingdom, indeterminate administrative detention, at least until the Belmarsh case. In some ways, very much like the Internal Security Act in Singapore, but without any pretense of rehabilitation. Singapore has used its internal security acts, which from a Western perspective are a due process horror, to detain about 40 people since 9/11 on terrorist grounds. Singapore has also reformulated the Internal Security Act and sold it both at home and abroad as an anti-terrorism act. But the thing that's often not mentioned about Singapore is of those 60 detainees, 40 have now been released. And they're released not on anything as tight as British control orders or the control orders that are used in Canada with respect to our administrative security certificate detainees. So you have a sense where the West is learning from harsher regimes, but not always with the same safety valves that those regimes, for reasons particular to their particular legal and political cultures, have. So that is, targeted killing may mean one thing in Israel, where virtually everything is judiciable. It may mean quite another thing in Washington, where there is what I've called extra legalism. And by extra legalism, American extra legalism, I mean the legal system is employed, as it was, say, in the torture memos, to defend what most people think is illegal actions. And so this is very important when we look at the migration of terrorism laws and terrorism practices. Something that comes from one country with its own set of political and legal safeguards is going to be something quite different when it's picked up and transplanted in another country. So for example, Australia has control orders, but those control orders exist in a very different environment than they do in this country. This process of migration is an important one, but care really must be taken to understand the different political and legal contexts that the transplants operate in. So finally, I'm not in this room going to go through the UK's post 9/11 experience. Many of you know this better than I. But I do want to point out that as someone, an outsider, if you will, looking at the countries that I've looked at, I have found far more British influence on counterterrorism laws than American influence. So when I went to Indonesia, it was very interesting, especially the younger people that I met viewed me with a lot of suspicion. Looks like an American, talks like an American, probably is an American. Are you going to bring me the Patriot Act? My message for them, although I actually didn't package it quite this way, is you might be happier with the Patriot Act than you would with the Terrorism Act 2000. Because in my view, if you compare the Terrorism Act 2000 and the Patriot Act, the Patriot Act looks mild. The Patriot Act has a lot of bad press, but when it comes to issues like the definition of terrorism, when it comes to innovations on the criminal justice system, the Patriot Act is really comparatively mild. So the British influence is one that looks both backwards in terms of the ISA, the Internal Security Acts in Singapore and Malaysia, the emergency regulations of 1945 in Palestine, which are still used in Israel, and there's some interesting migration between those two regimes. So Britain has a huge historical influence, and then of course you have the Terrorism Act 2000, you have control orders, you have special advocates, and you have Resolution 1624, which was enacted after the London bombings. Prime Minister Blair had much less problems getting his concern about the incitement of terrorism through the Security Council than he did through his own parliament. And so you have an export of a European concept of what I would submit is a European concept of militant democracy. That is this idea that we must criminalize not only actions that lead to violence, but ideas that support violence. And of course, when you know that idea has firm constitutional soundings in Article 17 of the European Convention on Human Rights, but it plays very differently in Damascus and Cairo and Jakarta. But when Resolution 1624, I would suggest, embraces these ideas of militant democracy, it exports them into countries that are perhaps not all that democratic. I've already spoken a little bit about the United States. As I say, to my mind, the Patriot Act is comparatively mild to the Terrorism Act 2000, but the real story of the American response is what was not authorized in the Patriot Act. So there's no preventive arrest provisions in the Patriot Act, so you get de facto preventive arrest through the abuse of grand jury warrants. So people were basically detained under the legal fiction that they were being detained as witnesses for the grand jury without any of these debates that you've had about 7, 28, 14, 90 days, right? This is an example of what I would call extra-legalism. Similarly, you have the NSA expansion of warrantless spying, subsequently revealed by the New York Times, subsequently then essentially ratified by the legislature. And you have military detention of both citizens like Padilla and non-citizens, and you have targeted killings. So when I look at the United States, the legislative record is not nearly as harsh or as exportable as the British legislative record. So if people in Indonesia were worried that I was bringing the contagion of the Patriot Act with me, I physically could not do that. I mean, I could not export the Patriot Act, even if I wanted to, unless I had a U.S. code with me and I had all the intricacies of American legalism. The Terrorism Act 2000, however, travels fairly well. That's my take on at least the relevant legal influences of those two powers. So finally, what are my kind of bottom line conclusions? And these are obviously going to be controversial. I won't fully justify them, and I'm sure some of you will challenge me on it. One conclusion is that third models, that is, models that are not based on the traditional law of crime or the law of war, whether that's Guantanamo, Belmarsh, control orders, and Canadian security certificates, have not worked particularly well after 9/11. And what's the criteria of success here? Well, I think the criteria of success also has to recognize that the bad press that these innovations get and the legal and political controversy that they cause may be contributing to part of the problem, right? So, you know, I'm not going to get into the debate about, you know, is Al-Qaeda central dead or is it an ideology, but I think clearly people who are influenced by the ideology of Al-Qaeda will look at these things as something that may help recruit people into terrorism. I mean, that certainly was President Obama's view when he came into office and sought to close Guantanamo. So the third models haven't worked out particularly well. There is a move back to the criminal law, but as Professor Hodgins and Tadros and others have written about, the criminal law itself is under strain. And I think some of this strain is through an importation of an intelligence paradigm into the criminal law. So intelligence agencies and security services are rightly concerned about people's associations and people's training and people's perhaps ambiguous acts. But when that worldview, that concern about the prevention of perhaps even remote and ambiguous risks of terrorism is brought into the criminal law, it really challenges some of the fundamentals of criminal law based on the idea that, you know, you're going to be guilty of a crime if you commit a criminal act and if you do so with some degree of criminal fault. It's not only the criminal law that's under strain, it's the criminal trial. Because now, as a result of the expansion of the criminal law in UK, Canada, Australia, any terrorism prosecution is going to involve gobs of security intelligence. The security intelligence are going to be all over the people who are accused of crime. And with this, we have the dilemmas about whether, even if the intelligence is not used as evidence, and often it won't, I mean, here you don't even use intercept as evidence, we have this issue of whether the accused has a right to disclosure of the unused intelligence as a requirement of a fair trial. So again, this issue of intelligence becoming evidence is for me one of the chief 9/11 facts. As I've said, I think there is a sense the Western democracies have catched up with those with more experience with terrorism. And this does speak to, I think, a certain change in basic values and parameters. What do we do about accountability? Well, if we're talking about this transnational laws, transnational investigations, where are the mechanisms of accountability? Who holds the Counterterrorism Committee accountable for some of the blind eye that it has turned to practices and laws that infringe human rights? I fear the answer is no one. We have UN special rapporteurs, the Committee Against Torture, the Human Rights Council, and so forth. But there's a huge transnational accountability gap. And, you know, interestingly enough, it's been some volunteer organizations and civil society that have done some of the most important work in trying to fill this accountability gap. So things like the International Commission of Jurists, who had a kind of worldwide tour where they heard both from security experts and civil society, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, these people are trying to plug the accountability gaps. But I'm sure that they would be the first to, you know, as Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead said, you know, someone has to do it. It's just really pathetic that it's us. That's a joke. But anyway, accountability for transnational terrorism investigations. This was an issue that we confronted in the Arar inquiry. We were appointed only because of a huge controversy in Canada. So public inquiries are only appointed at the discretion of the government. We hopefully had some degree of accountability with respect to Canadian officials, but of course the U.S. and Syria did not participate, even though they were asked to. And so we have this whole-of-government approach to terrorism. So even at the domestic level, there is a disjunction between accountability, which is largely based on silo, agency-based accountability, and the fact that whole-of-government government is now being mobilized in attempting to prevent terrorism. So your ongoing inquiry into the rendition to torture, like our Arar inquiry, is the only institution that really will have a remit that can cover the police, the foreign, the domestic security service, foreign affairs, consular, customs, and the like. And all of these people are now in the counterterrorism business. They have more money. They're breaking down walls. Unfortunately, the accountability bodies have not kept pace. Then finally, I would just end that one of the reasons why I think accountability is so important is that we need to review continuously both for efficacy and for propriety. And I increasingly think that these issues are really not all that divorced. You know, too often the failures of counterterrorism post 9/11 have been failures that both are not particularly efficacious in preventing terrorism, but also violate human rights, and by doing that, perhaps lead into a potential cycle of more terrorism. Thank you very much for your attention.